Welcome to the Radius Project, what happens when we explore the edges, paths, and landmarks of a city and meet our neighbors.
We have to change how we look at things and how we utilize our resources. And the river is a mad, crazy, beautiful resource that we don't utilize.
This first Jewish community that settled first on the east side near the river is basically the foundation of our community today.
It's probably one of the nicest venues I've ever been in. I've rode a number of rivers in the East Coast. If you just look down at the Buckley Bridge skyline, it's just beautiful. But up the other side of the river, you just go into some other place. It gets you out of bed in the morning, for sure. You don't want to miss it.
We're finding unexpected stories close to spots you might already know. Mapping Hartford, Connecticut in a new way. I'm Jamil Ragland.
And I'm Julia Pistel. Jamil and I both live in Hartford. He lives in the North End and I live south of downtown.
In each episode, we'll look at a well-known landmark and then explore the half-mile radius around it.
We're searching for some new, or maybe some old, perspectives on our home, its beauties, its issues, and most importantly, its people.
Today, we're going to start at one of the places that perhaps shaped our city more than any other landmark, although we may not even notice it because it's been walled off and separated from our daily lives. It's been around forever, a settling point for Jewish migrants, Dutch explorers, and Wampanoag Indians.
Quonnetucket is the Algonquin saying, word for the river, which means long tidal river or long tidal river land. And even the history of what we call Connecticut Indians, you can't understand that unless you understand the history of the Wampanoags, unless you understand the history of the Shinnecocks. It all boils down to the river and geography. That's why they call this place Connecticut, because the river is not a static force. It's something that connects us all.
That's Lee Mixashan Razi. He's a Hartford native and a musician. He's African-American and Algonquin.
There's evidence that Native people were making use of the river as far back as around 6,000 BC. 4,000 years later, they were making larger camps and planting seeds. With the introduction of maize, beans, and squash came more permanent settlements, which were in place until the 17th century when the Dutch traders arrived.
In Connecticut, Native people have played a very important part in the creation of this very powerful economy. You know, it's like Native people started the first industries here. The Connecticut River, Quonnetucket, this region, this area around Hartford, the greater Hartford area, the Windsors, these have always been like the place that fed the whole region.
Control of trade caused tensions between the Native Americans and the European settlers. But it wasn't until members of the Pequots murdered several Englishmen and the tribe refused to turn the murderers over that it became a war.
The 1637 Pequot War was not quick or easy. The Pequots held their own for months until a massacre at Mystic introduced them to English-style warfare. Hundreds of Native men, women, and children were killed. By the end of the war, most of the Pequots were gone or captured and enslaved.
Today, we're far removed from this history and from our reliance on the river for our daily lives.
The river has always been a multicultural meeting place. It's always been that. You've seen all kinds of people on the river, and you still do. People who do have access to any kind of water vessel, be it a canoe or motorboat or jet ski or whatever, they all swim in it. It's the people who don't have access to it are still under this, you know, conclusion that the river is as dirty as it was 50 years ago, and it's not the case.
I wanted to find people today that are connected to the river, that use it and enjoy it every single day. Last summer, I signed up for a rowing class. I was asked by a friend when the last time I went hot turkey on something, all in, right away. I lived in Hartford for 8 years, and like most people, my stomping grounds were well-worn. I took myself down to a place I've lived close to my entire life in this city, the Connecticut River. I had run on its paths, hung out at the amphitheater, watched the sunsets, crossed the bridges, but I had never actually been out on the water. I wanted to see what I didn't know about this vital part of my city, how the water felt against the oars, how the weather affects the day, and most of all, how far and how hard I could row.
Are you?
Sure. You gonna try and make the island this time?
Yes, sure. You gotta do a good job, right?
So before you get in, remember, oars out first before you get in.
The Riverfront Boathouse attracts students who have never rowed before and students who have been committed to the sport for a lifetime. The only requirement is a willingness to rise at dawn. The instructors not only run public lessons and races, but high school programs and adaptive programs for the blind, deaf, and disabled.
Hector Diaz, my instructor, started rowing through a Trinity College program.
I'm like, all right, I'm gonna be good at this. So as soon as I went there the first day, touched an arm, like, oh yeah, I love this sport already. So from there, just took off.
I hoped that when I got in the shell, I would be a prodigy. Unfortunately, I underestimated the precision of balance in the sport. The moment you slide into the seat, you're compromising with the water gods. Don't fall in. Don't fall in. When Hector pushes me off the dock, each time he shouts, hands left over right, never pull in, never let go.
Never pull in, especially the never let go part. It definitely makes you more patient as a person, especially with other people who aren't picking it up as quickly. And then, I don't know, it just makes me a better person when I row, so.
Look at my office, right? I mean, sun is shining, it's early mornings, it's nice.
Chris Hayes runs the rowing program. During the rowing season, he's up and out by 5:45 and there until 6 at night.
Again, all the different people that come in, they're fun and they're here, they have the same passion, right? They're here to row, they're here to experience nature, they're here to experience the river, and so to be able to feed off that enthusiasm is a lot of fun.
Before I got in the boat, I thought my mind would be focused on the shell, the oars, my own strength. But once you're out there, moving against the water in rhythm, you can't help but notice the beauty of the river. The way the morning air and light change every single day of the season, the wind and the rain on the water, the idea that you're out there while the city is still asleep, the birds that line the river, squat the sandbars, and most of all, the eagles.
It's absolutely beautiful. I mean, you have the city lights. There's so much wildlife, which is crazy. You know, you'll be in the middle of the piece, and I've had some rowers be like, look at that bald eagle. And there's just something about being in a city atmosphere and then just having something so beautiful and calm and relaxing alongside it.
So many of the rowers I met come out to the water to find nature in a city that has built walls and highways around its most wild asset.
Well, it's beautiful, right? Once you get up beyond the railroad bridge, it pretty much goes on forever. Everybody knows about the bald eagles, right? They're everywhere, right? Up there. And then the herons are everywhere. The egrets come in like a couple weeks ago. And then in the latter part of August, I think it's the shad start jumping. I've seen deer cross the river. It's all around you. You just stop and just take it in.
The light, particularly the early dawn light, as we were seeing a few moments ago, on the water just makes it, it's. If I were a painter, I'd be out here painting it. It's beautiful. And the wildlife, I love the great blue heron. They look like prehistoric animals. We almost always see them. And then sometimes just the gulls flying over are wonderful. We see fish jumping at times. You can get 10 minutes away from here rowing, and you can't see the city anymore. And it's just amazing that there's something right here that's so close to downtown. And the last thing that disappears is a little green roof on a building in East Hartford. And I always sort of do when that building disappears, because you feel like you're in Vermont.
That's Rebecca Liker, Jim Clary, and Virginia DeLima. Before she ran off to join her team, DeLima gave us a great lead for our next interview.
As an aside, have you been talking to the USGS about monitoring the river?
No.
I haven't talked to them yet. Okay. Do you know people at the USGS?
I certainly do. I retired from the USGS a bit ago. If you look at the Bulkley Bridge down here, you can't see it from this. Well, you can see it from the side. If you look through the arch that's on the right-hand side, even in the dim, you can see sort of a white spot on what looks like one of the columns. That actually isn't part of the bridge, though you'd think it is. It's a USGS gauging station. And that's the point where we monitor the height of the river in the Hartford area. And that information is available on the web. In the daylight, you can see that there's a structure up on the bridge deck with an antenna, and it's transmitting the data via satellite in real time.
How are you?
Hi, John. I'm Julia.
Hi, Julia. Nice to meet you.
Thanks for meeting us.
Oh, no problem.
Gotta get the sound of this ice crackling. So beautiful.
Enter John Mullaney, hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey.
We met him as the ice floes were just starting to crack down the bend in the river.
You know, the spring when it's breaking up and it's really thick and it's like a glacier out here and all that starts to break up. I think it starts to pile up on the bridge, you know, where it comes through the arch.
USGS is an agency under the Department of Interior, and especially in Connecticut, we do a lot of work in water resources. So we're monitoring the flows of all the major rivers in the state. We do lots of water quality sampling, groundwater levels, along with a lot of other studies on particular topics related to water. So in Connecticut, we're pretty much a water agency.
While we're on our way to the gauging station, John told us about the water quality of the river today.
Well, rivers like the Connecticut River are they're really quite a bit better than they were in 1972, which is the good news, I think, for the most part. At least for the things that I'm looking at, they've improved a lot. Things like nutrients that we're concerned about for Long Island Sound. I think from some of our other data, we can see that, you know, things like bacteria are much less.
John said that the only time he thinks twice about swimming in the river is after a heavy rainstorm.
When you talk about when the major highways were built through the city, I think it actually relates to water quality in the river, because the river was not really seen as a resource at the time, and it was considered to be an open sewer. There's also a lot of interest in really promoting the transportation and the highway system, and, you know, it's just where people were thinking at that time, I think. There are still problems, but by and large, it's a much better river.
John said that he thinks of the river as the lifeblood of New England, because it runs through the heart of most of its states. But this lifeblood has also caused a lot of destruction.
The backside of this pier here is where our river gauge is, and it's actually like a well that goes down below the river level and where we measure river height. And it's kind of interesting to think about our elevations for the various floods on the Connecticut River, and that's a big part of history here in Hartford and the riverfront, especially when we look at the 1936 flood up there at an elevation of 37 feet. And the most interesting thing to think about that was that 37 feet was before these flood walls were built. So if you think about that 37 feet spreading across the valley, it's even that more impressive.
The flood of 1936 devastated businesses and homes on the riverfront. The Jewish community living on Front Street was hit hard.
There were a lot of stories about the flood. One in particular was, along with this community that first settled in Hartford, of course, became the building of many synagogues. At one time, there were 13 synagogues in the city of Hartford. Today, of course, there are none.
Estelle Kafer runs the Jewish Historical Society of Greater Hartford.
One particular synagogue that was on Market Street, Ados Israel, when the water started rising in 1936, the members realized that they had to go into the synagogue and save the Torah scrolls.
The Jewish Historical Society has been collecting photos and archival audio from those early Hartford days.
On August the 19th, 1899, the Ados Israel was dedicated then, which was the pride and joy of the Orthodox people of Hartford.
That's Herman Holtz from a 1975 interview. Holtz was an active member of the Jewish community in Hartford. His family helped found the congregation Ados Israel, the city's oldest synagogue.
Holtz was one of the men that saved the scrolls during the flood of 1936.
I went back in the synagogue at 9 o'clock, and there was a lot of water in front of the synagogue in Market Street, but I went through that water and down in the synagogue, and no water at all in the synagogue, down in the vestry. But I thought in case that it should flow in, I better be sure and take out the three Sefer Torahs from the daily minion room and put them upstairs in the main sanctuary on the table, the shulchan, where we read the Torahs every Shabbos. I remember carrying two small Torahs together, put them on the table, and I went back for another Torah, and it was a large one. And just as I was coming out from the prayer room, just about to make the stairway, I heard a terrible crash. And by the time I was taking those Torahs, the water had built up in the vestry entrance and crashed through those doors, and I missed that water by a second. But I remember how scared I was. I sat on the stairs with the Sefer Torah, and I just shook because I thought that was the end.
You don't know how to swim?
I could swim all right. I did place that last Torah on the center of the synagogue shul from the table, and I couldn't get out to the front. I couldn't get out the back, and I couldn't get out the front. I jumped out the side window onto the coal pile, so it was a coal yard next door to the old Market Street synagogue. And then, of course, everything was underwater by 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, everything was underwater. And around 1 o'clock, I went down to the east side at Windsor Street. And I then asked an officer of the police department if he would be good enough to get me over to the synagogue. We went down Pleasant Street, and I remember as we were going down Pleasant Street, barrels and boxes and whatnot was hitting us all sides. But we went into Market Street, and we went right over the iron gates that was in front of the Market Street synagogue. The water was so high. Went right over the gates. And we went right into the shul with his boat, right down the aisle to the Orin Kodesh, the three of us. And we took out the Sefer Torahs and all the Nevi'im and put it in the rowboat. I got into the Orin Kodesh and I stood there and handed the Torahs to him in the boat with the policeman. And finally we got all the 18 Torahs and all the Nevi'im, and we rode back to the stairway leading to the second floor, to the ladies' balcony. And we placed the Torahs on the in the balcony facing Market Street. I felt if the water still rise and still going, we'll be able to break the front windows and get the Torahs out from the front of the shul. But the water did just go up to the balcony floors of the balcony in the synagogue.
They never were able to fully restore the Ados Israel Synagogue, mostly due to high costs. So they sold the building and moved to a Unitarian prayer house on Pearl Street.
Well, the early community was very small. You know, it was really probably only a few hundred Jews. But it really was some peddlers that came here and set up businesses with push carts in this neighborhood. They lived in flats and tenements, and it was a poor area.
What started out as poor peddlers in the 1820s and 30s became a vibrant, tight-knit community and a shopping destination by the early 1900s.
I am still in awe of the wonderful contributions that the Jewish community made to Hartford, and I'm always very impressed with how much of the city's economic growth was due to the first Jewish peddlers and business owners.
There were so many notable community members who came out of the Front Street District, like Gerson Fox, the founder of the famous G. Fox department store, and Sophie Tucker, who grew up on Front Street. She was the daughter of a woman who had helped to purchase the chandelier at the Ados Israel Synagogue. Sophie's father had a restaurant on Front Street where she'd sing songs as a young girl. Inspired by the vaudeville stars that came through the restaurant, she eventually made her way to New York and toured across the country.
Next to things all right. Say, for his love I'm so hungry that his cheeks I'll start a bite. And if he's never had his moments, well, I guess he will tonight.
She became one of vaudeville's biggest stars and was known as the last of the Red Hot Mamas. For the musical theater geeks, here's your fun fact. Sophie Tucker is the inspiration for matron Mama Morton, played by Queen Latifah in the Oscar-winning movie Chicago.
You can get no chance to fight, and my name isn't Sophie Tucker. If that guy don't fall tonight.
The history of the riverfront is one of change. After the floods, most immigrants who had settled there slowly moved away. In the 1960s, the city of Hartford raised the entire Front Street area, including the beautiful Adels Israel Synagogue, to build Constitution Plaza.
The newer Front Street District, a few blocks away, is named after the old neighborhood. It's all part of the city's effort to revitalize this once thriving part of town. At the same time, Hartford's trying to bring people back to the river. One of those efforts is Riverfront Recapture. But even that project did not come without displacing what was already here.
Riverside Park, back in the day, had a swimming pool, a beautiful pool called Pilates Pool. And most people who grew up in the North End from anywhere from like 35 years back pretty much learned how to swim at Pilates Pool. I was a lifeguard at Pilates Pool.
Lee Mixashan Razi said he misses the community created by the pool and the basketball courts.
Back, I believe it was around 85, you know, it was falling into disrepair. And when the park got taken over by Riverfront Recapture, the first thing they did immediately was tear down the pool and tear down the basketball courts. And that had a definite impact on who was using the park. Because before, the residents of the North End, I mean, that was one of the resources that everybody would go down. That was just the hang.
He said the city could be doing more to help people get out on the river with activities like swimming and canoeing.
It's this kind of access that's one goal of Recapture. Features like the Riverfront Plaza draw crowds from in and outside of the city. We stopped downtown one day when both Riverfest and Kineticon were drawing thousands to the riverfront.
I'm Jennifer Teig von Hoffman. I'm from Boston. Well, right now I am in a panda suit with a panda pochette and carrying my friend Penguin San, and I am cosplaying from a show called Polar Bears Cafe. I am enjoying the city today. I must admit, mostly when I come to Hartford, it is for Kineticon. Hartford has always been a great host city for us from my perspective as an attendee. Depending on the schedule, next year coming down for Kineticon, I would arrange to come in early or stay late if I can get a hit a Yard Goats game here.
My name is Angel Cordero, and I'm a downtown ambassador. Oh, I do everything. I help people every day. I stop people from bothering people, keep them safe, and keep the streets clean.
So what are some of your favorite things about Hartford?
Everything. Historics, spots like Riverfront, Convention Center, the Excel Center. Everything has a history behind it, the Arch.
My name is Nancy Chapin. Oh, we came down because we heard the advertisements about Riverfest, and I wanted to come back to Hartford and see all the beautiful buildings. I worked here many years ago at Travelers, and we're out here just to enjoy the day.
What are your favorite things about Hartford?
The architecture, and I think the arts, and the fine restaurants.
I'm Siobhan.
And you?
I'm Jules.
And I'm Gabriel.
TMA 60 is a group where everyone from basically anywhere you can see. Oh, Connecticut, like Hartford, New Britain, East Hartford. Okay. And we compete basically around the world. We've gone to World of Dance in Boston. We're going to dances to compete.
So where are you guys from? What towns are you guys from?
I'm from East Hartford.
I'm from New Britain.
And I'm from Hartford.
And how does it feel to be in Hartford today on the river?
Well, I mean, I've been going to the riverfront for a while, but I've never actually performed at the riverfront. So it's new for this. But performing-wise, I'm just excited for it, yeah.
When you say you go to the riverfront for a while, what do you usually do?
Well, I usually come up here to watch the fireworks, eat, and just hang out with friends. I mean, we still dance around sometimes, but it's just a great environment. I guess the riverfront is just a time for everybody to come through for the community.
Fireworks. Gotta love them. The kids love them. So we made the trek from Bristol on the wonderful fast track bus. Made it through this maze of people just to catch the grand finale, but it was worth it. The kids had a blast. We're enjoying ourselves and we're just getting ready to make the trek back, catch the bus back home.
I think it was one of the best fireworks display I've ever seen, especially the ones with the gold, and they kept like exploding and exploding. Oh, it was gorgeous. I loved it.
Visitors for these riverside events now have to pass through the shadow of the Phoenix Building as they walk towards the water. Since 1805, there has been at least one company named Phoenix here along the river. First, the Phoenix Foundry, which made brass memorial plaques, and then Phoenix Insurance also set up shop near the river.
They're right near the site where so many communities settled, only to be forced out by war or flood or redevelopment. The whole optimism and pessimism of Hartford is contained in that one word, Phoenix. Is our city bursting into flames, or is it rising out of its own ashes? Either way, it seems there will always be a new community trying to recapture the riverfront. For an interactive map with photos from our interviews around the Connecticut River, visit radiusproject.org. There you can hear our other episodes centered around Keeney Park, Mount Olive Church, Mazzucato's Bakery, and Park Street. I'm Julia Pistel.
And I'm Jamil Raglan. Our podcast is also produced by Jay Holt and Katie Tularski. Thanks to Heather Brandon, Beth Messina, Shayna Surick, Rob Gabbery, Ryan Karen King, Charlie Smart, John Dankosky, and Kevin McBride.
Radius is made possible by the Greater Hartford Arts Council and the City of Hartford Arts and Heritage Jobs Grant Program. Tank Sauce produced our theme music. All other music in this episode is from Lee Mixashan Razi. For more info, go to radiusproject.org.
It smells like toast.
Yeah, I always notice. I've often wondered where that smell comes from.
This is the first time I've smelled it.
No, you smell that frequently down here. It's
For the recording purposes, we're like right near the little fork next to the bike and walk pedestrian overpass, and it smells pretty strongly of toast.
No, but that's a common smell. I've smelled that many times here. It must be something. It must be some incinerator somewhere nearby. Yeah. There are a variety of smells down here. Different times.